It is delightful to see you here this evening. We appreciate our visitors and all of you who are here and hope that your future travels bring you safely to your destination. We're talking on the book of Ecclesiastes. We have been for several weeks, and tonight in chapter 10, I call it Dead Flies, Deadly Snakes, and Dangerous Birds, all of which are mentioned in this chapter. One thing about Ecclesiastes, it never gets dull. It has all kinds of illustrations about one thing or another, usually in the same chapter. And this is no different from the others. Little sins are something that people find themselves defending from time to time. Think about little sins is, first of all, there's no such thing. And second, the problem is that they tend to grow as they tend to be practiced. And we find people who talk about little sins or little things. They're just my business. They don't belong to anybody else's business. They don't pertain to anybody else. They don't hurt anybody. They don't even hurt me. And they include in that something like fornication or drunkenness. Those have become little sins that are defended by people in our society. And that just illustrates how they grow in gravity as time goes on and as people continue to defend themselves. All so-called little sins are dangerous. All of them are dangerous. They break down character, they influence a person, and they destroy the elements of what he ought to be, a brick at a time. You may have a tornado that sweeps through a territory that hits a brick house and absolutely levels it to the ground. That's the quick way. Or you could have a fellow who's living in his house and he doesn't like it. So every day he goes out and takes one brick away from what's constituting the outside of that house. Every day he gets a brick. Now after several years, the rain has been able to come in place. He takes the part of the roof off every day and the rest of it. Finally, it's down too. Now, it ended up in the same place, didn't it, as the tornado. It wasn't as violent as the tornado. It was more prolonged. But it was the same effect. Little sins, so-called, are just like that. You end up in exactly the same place. Especially after years of practicing these so-called little sins, they would be every bit as big as any big sin you're ever going to find. That's foolish terminology, and it's based on a person's desire not to obey God, but to do what he wants. This being in mind, we think about how these little sins grow. Procrastination. I'll get around to it tomorrow. And you notice that tomorrow sometimes just never gets around to us. Or you think about indecision. Here's a person who needs to do something. He can't make up his mind and just keeps putting it off until it's too late to do so and disaster ensues. Or you have undue levity. All of us like to laugh. All of us like to smile. But have you ever met a person who can't do anything but that? That has happened. Or you think about despondency. You could refer to anxiety. You could talk about lack of self-control. All of which the Bible either, and depending on the word here, commands or tells you to abstain from. You see, these things are very similar to what we read in Proverbs. Ecclesiastes 10 is very similar to Proverbs. Solomon wrote both, and it seems that here he's saying, now there are some things I want to talk about, and I'm going to put them in this form that I had when I wrote the book of Proverbs, and I hope that it will be helpful. Well, I believe it will be helpful if we'll look at what he had to say. The first thing I see in the first three verses is that foolishness destroys. And he paints a pretty ugly picture of it here. In chapter 7, verse 1, we've already seen the statement that a good name is better than precious ointment. He's already brought up ointment. And a good name is like that precious ointment. Don't do anything to sully it or to leave it with a bad taste in the mouth or a bad reputation. Well, the same thing here, only a different subject besides the name. Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor. So does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. Wisdom and honor and perfume please us, don't they? Those are good things. We want those. We're for them. But they can all be nullified by a little folly, just as a fly can nullify the effects of perfume. Dead flies make the perfume stink. Imagine this, some of you gentlemen here. It's your anniversary. And you go down to the place where they sell very fine perfumes, and you look at the prices, and you say, whoo, that's rich. That's rich. That ought to have the Fountain of Life in it to cost that much. And he says, well, over here, however, we have this bottle that one of our helpers was showing to someone, and a fly flew into it and died in it, and it's still in there. I'll sell that to you for $20. And he says, what a bargain. I can get the fly out easily enough. And so he goes home and he tells his wife all about it. And I've got you some of the best perfume you'll ever see. And I can get that dead fly out if you want. Now, I'll leave it up to you to determine how well that's going to go over. I don't want to risk anything like that. I don't like broken bones. But the fact of it is, one dead fly ruins the entire bottle of ointment. It doesn't have to be full of flies to be ruined, does it? She takes one look, and she has nothing to do with that ointment. Same thing with one reckless moment. How serious this is. One reckless moment. One careless word. One inconsidered remark. And you have a reputation is gone forever. It will never return. And all of us have known occasions where somebody has done things like this. It's always easier to tear down than it is to build up. Going out and taking a brick off the house every day is not really a whole lot of work. And taking a little bit of character off of us every day doesn't really take a lot of work. It comes pretty easily, especially as we blend in with those who justify such things. But you see this happening all through Scripture. Hebrews 12 speaks of Esau when he says, lest there be any fornicator, or a profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. Now think about this. The Hebrew writer is concerned that what happened to Esau will happen to his readers. That's why he brings this up. It runs like a thread throughout the entire epistle. Lest there be a fornicator or a profane person, a person who defiles things, just as Esau defiled his birthright. And notice, it didn't take several meals to get him to do this. One morsel of food. We would say a single meal is all it took for him to give up this precious possession of his birthright. He ate the meal and he lost on both counts. That's a profane person. The area before the temple is profane. Profanum is before the temple, the place where people walk and treat it like it's nothing. He treated something holy, as though it were the area before the temple. Something totally unholy. We cannot afford to take one step in that direction. Folly stinks. It's associated with evil. And when you think about a fool in scriptural parlance, don't think of a person who doesn't have much of a mind. Sometimes they're brilliant people. Some of the most brilliant people are the people that the Bible would call fools. We have to be careful in our use of it. But there is an element of silliness and foolishness in it, of a lack of a brain sometimes for what he says and does, and putting his foot in his mouth and never stop talking and on, as he mentions in this chapter. But it's basically a moral problem. And you see this nowhere more clearly than in Proverbs. It's a moral issue. He's a fool because he thinks he can trifle with the things of God and live to tell about it. That's what a fool is. In chapter 8, verse 11, we saw this last week, 2 weeks ago. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Now that's, by definition, a fool. And what he's doing in verse 11, he's saying, look, he's sinning, nothing happened to him. I've sinned, nothing happens to me. So it's full steam ahead. Do what you please. It's anybody's game. Aaron, in Exodus 32, you know what he did. Helping to make a golden calf. Who would have thought Aaron, of all people, would do so? Think about it. Aaron is living in the midst of a bunch of, and I say this advisedly, fools, foolish people. They show it over and over. And it doesn't take long for them to rub off on him. Is there a lesson here for me? What kind of society do we live in? A society very similar to what Aaron lived in, only in many ways worse. And how prone am I to be influenced by these goings on around me? Moses, Numbers 20. Who would have thought Moses would get up and say, "Must we fetch you water out of this rock?" Moses too. Dealing with foolish people all the time, like with silly sheep. He got to the point where he's exasperated and he overspeaks. And he never goes to the promised land because of it. And then you think about 1 Corinthians 5 verse 6. Poor Paul, having to deal with the case of fornication in the congregation and the kind of fornication you would never even have expected to be possible among the people of God. He says a little leaven leavens the whole lump. A little is all it takes. A little leaven spreads throughout the entire loaf. Now, there is such a thing then as a little bad and a large disaster. It doesn't take long for a little folly to outweigh wisdom. You have one fly in the ointment. You have one unguarded moment. You have one sinner. Chapter 9, at verse 18, look at the last verse of chapter 9. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner, one, destroys much good. Joshua 7, one Achan is all it took for the children of Israel to lose their next battle and go down ingloriously. One act on the part of Ananias and Sapphira. Here are two people, but one act. It's all it took for them both to die within a 3-hour space of one another. In 2 Kings 20, look at Hezekiah. He has weathered the storm with Assyria. He's done it in absolutely amazingly faithful fashion. He has prayed to God over and over. God has spared him. The Assyrians have gone packing. And Hezekiah has come out victorious because of his faith and his trust in his God. And now when the Babylonians send envoys to Hezekiah, "We've heard you've been sick. We wanted to come visit." He shows them everything, including his treasures. After they leave, Isaiah says, "What do they see here? What did you show them?" "I showed them everything." It's like giving a fox a tour of the hen house. And he says, "The day's coming when they will be coming back. Not merely as visitors, but as raiders of this place. They'll take all this gold you've piled up. You won't have any left. And they'll take your own offspring to be eunuchs in a faraway land of Babylon." Who would have thought this would happen to Hezekiah? Whenever we read Ecclesiastes, we need to stop and say, is this something I'm doing? Is this something I've done? Is it possible I'm on the verge of doing this? Because it is very serious. Ezekiel 18:24, one of my favorite illustrations of this. "But when a righteous man turns away from his righteousness and commits iniquity, and does according to all the abominations that the wicked man does, shall he live?" Here's a case of apostasy. He's turned away from the righteousness of God and he's turned to sin. "Shall he live? All the righteousness which he has done shall not be remembered." You see that? He's blotted his slate clean. No acts of righteousness with this man. All I can see is the ugly stain of his present sin. "Because of the unfaithfulness of which he is guilty and the sin which he has committed, because of them he shall die." Somebody says, "That's not fair. He's lived a whole life of faithfulness to God, and now one failure, and he's being condemned." It's that way in all of life. When it comes to the health arena, the doctor says, "We have found a cell that looks suspicious." What do you want? Do you say, "One little cell? One little cell didn't hurt. One little possibility of disease, I'm not worried about that. It's a little thing." No, we leave little things to sins. We don't talk about disease that way, do we? What do we say? "Get rid of it." You mean that one little cell? Get rid of it now. What if you don't? That one little cell can kill you. Isn't that right? That's the way it is. When you think about money, remember the Enron scandal a few years ago? One of the greatest hoaxes in marketing, one of the greatest hoaxes and the commodities market and all this, it was just a big false facade. There's never been anything quite like it in this country. And yet people place their trust, put all their savings in it, and next thing you know, it's gone. It's gone. They call it the Enron scandal. You think about marriage. All of us have known people that we've respected, even people of the world who try to lead moral lives and they're in the public's eye. A famous basketball coach, for example. And he's an attractive young man, and he has a winning record, and he's a very nice guy, and he treats people well. You think, what? You know, there's some people out there that are just pretty good people. Then you find out that he's been caught being unfaithful to his wife. And you think, how in the world? All it takes is one. And you go a little further, and you see the same thing's true with anger. A 70-year-old has never hurt anybody in his life. But someone irritates him, he grabs his gun, he kills someone in a fit of anger. And he pleads before the judge, I've never done this before, I'll never do it again. I have a clean record, you'll not see any long list of things I've committed that are evil. Let me go. What does the judge say? I'm sorry, you didn't have a list before, but you've got the first one now. And we'll have to deal with you accordingly. One little thing can put him in prison the rest of his life. It certainly can. And we could go on and on with this. But Ecclesiastes is emphasizing the importance of one attitude, one act, one fatal decision. Verse 2, folly is a heart defect, meaning it lacks sense. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Now, I don't want to insult anybody who's left-handed here. I'm sure in this audience somebody is. I'm not going to call you out. But the fact of it is, the Bible emphasizes a value of a right hand over a left for whatever reasons, as we're about to see. Here, this occasion shows a man lacking sense. The right hand, a place of honor and strength. The left hand, a place often of inferiority. Now, that's not my saying that. In Genesis 48, you remember the occasion where Jacob is about to bless Joseph's sons. They're in Egypt. He's about to bless Manasseh and Ephraim. So Joseph, coming to him, is very quick to put Manasseh, the older, in his left hand, coming at Jacob's right hand. Of course, Ephraim will be over here. When he's ready to bless, he crosses his hands and puts the right onto Ephraim and the left onto Manasseh. And he pronounces the blessing. The greater blessing comes on the younger son, Ephraim. And when he gets through, Joseph is ready to have a fit of apoplexy. What's going on here? What do you mean? You got your right hand on the wrong son. No, he says, I know what I'm doing. Manasseh will be blessed too. But he won't be blessed the way Ephraim will be blessed. And it turned out that way in their history. Not always in a good sense for Ephraim, but it did turn out that way. But the right hand was the place of the greater honor. Psalm 16:8, I've set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand. I shall not be moved. And then in Psalm 121, the Lord is your keeper, the Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. And we could go on and on with these. But the point that he's making is the wise man's heart guides him toward the right. The New American Standard and others are quick to point out here in verse 2. The foolish man's heart is at his left. And you recall in Matthew 25 when Jesus is pronouncing the blessing upon those who are on his right and the curse, the eternal curse on those who are on his left. Now, as you're facing him, you're looking at your left, but it's his right hand that is important. And you're looking at your right over here, but it's his left hand that's important. And it's those who are on the right that are blessed eternally, those who are on the left that are dismissed and rejected. The wise man's mind is his guardian. Romans 12, verse 2, speaks of this in very, very forceful terms. Now, you know, in the first 11 chapters, Paul has reached the heights of eloquence in describing the glory of God, the power of God, the gospel of God, the grace of God, the Son of God, and on and on. And so he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, based on all these facts, on all these blessings and all these mercies God has given you, I beseech you by the mercies of God, you present your bodies a living sacrifice. Verse 2, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You have to have a new way of thinking about things, that you may prove what is a good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Fill the mind with filth and you stay in sin. It's just that simple. What you put in the mind is what you're going to put into your actions. But fill that mind in a renewed sense, obsessed with doing God's will, and you're going to be going the right direction. You remember what mothers say when they're cooking or something in the kitchen? The kids just keep coming in and out. What does she say to them? All right, make up your mind. Either come in or stay out. Why does she say mind? Because the mind determines if they're going to listen or not. It determines where they're going to be. Make up your mind. Do you want in here or out there? You decide. The mind controls us. And that's what he's saying here as well. Now listen carefully. Of all centuries, the 20th century is the most like to the first. I'd never thought of this in my life. The 20th century is most like the first. Once again, Christians are a small minority in the midst of a despairing and pagan world, and they're confronted on every side with violence, hostility, ignorance, widespread immorality, and existential despair. They are thus thrust back into the very climate of the first century. Ian Blakelock wrote that, a professor at the University of Auckland, New Zealand, classics professor who knew his history very, very well. He died in 1983. Less than 40 years ago, he knew things were bad. But if you get on the website of the University of Auckland today, you'll find one of the signal patterns they will show you on their website is, we welcome those of the rainbow way of thinking. They go out of their way to advocate the very things he's talking about here. They would never have thought of this 40 years ago. But my, how times have changed. Yes, it's gone very much like the first century, because that's the way it was then. Let's go a little further. In verse 3, your folly is showing. Even when a fool walks along the way, he lacks wisdom, and he shows everyone that he is a fool. Your folly is showing. It shows in daily conduct. It shows in speech. He opens his mouth, and as soon as he does, it removes all doubt. Yes, this man is a fool. Listen to him curse God. That'll show you. Listen to him make some suggestive joke. That'll show you. And a number of other ways it could be done. He never leaves home without it, that is, without his folly. Now described, Ecclesiastes is pretty good at describing what he means by folly. It's a morally ignorant person. Chapter 2, verse 14. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. In chapter 4, at verse 5, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. He doesn't eat. He's lazy, too lazy to eat, so his body just consumes itself. A fool is lazy. Chapter 5, verse 3, he is long-winded. For a dream comes through much activity, but a fool's voice is known by his many words. He just can't quit talking. And then he's displeasing. Verse 4, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Rowdy songs characterize fools. In chapter 7, verse 5, it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. Better somebody rebuke you and set you on the right course than listen to that junk. That sounds very modern, doesn't it? And then shallow laughter, chapter 7, verse 6. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. He's noisy, but he has no profit in the noise he makes. He's easily angered, chapter 7, verse 9. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. In chapter 9, verse 17, he's stubborn. You can't tell him anything. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. In one passage, Proverbs 17, verse 10, it says, rebuke is more effective for a wise man than 100 blows on a fool. Go rebuke a wise man. One word, and he says, yes, sir, you know, you're right. I shouldn't have done that. But a fool, go out and give him 100 licks. 100 blows with a stick. He takes a beating and it didn't get through to him. Words penetrate the wise man's brain. A beating doesn't help the fool. Abraham Lincoln said, it's better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak out and remove all doubt. There have been occasions when I should have listened to that. Even a fool can escape detection when he's silent. But the problem is he can't quit talking. You know, fools talk and talk and talk and talk. And the more we talk, the more dangerous it becomes for us. Proverbs 17, he who has knowledge spares his words. And a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. Even a fool is counted wise when he holds his peace. When he shuts his lips, he is considered perceptive. Job says to his wife, you speak as one of the foolish women speak. That tells me two things. They're always talking, and he knew what they were. They gave themselves away. So do we. And this is telling us, don't let that happen. Now, foolishness also rules. Very sadly, this is the case. Chapter 10, verse 4, if the spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post, for conciliation pacifies great offenses. I find this to be a matter of self-control as much as anything in verse 4. Conciliation refers to calmness, a calm response. He's walked in, he has said something, it's not even your fault, and he blames you for it. Something of that nature. In Proverbs 16, 4, as messengers of death is the king's wrath, but a wise man will appease it. What should we do when a man of power, a boss or someone, comes in and he just gives us down the road for something that's not even our fault? The principle, generally speaking, is less said as soonest mended. When a person says, as I heard one man say on occasion, when he was a little angry, he said, I'm going to vent myself. And boy, he did. And he had to come back later and make some severe apologies for what he had said to a very good man. And I suggest to you, the least said, soon is mended. Be patient and poised when he comes in. You remember in Judges 8, when Gideon is still chasing the Midianites, the people of Ephraim meet him. And they've done their part at the river. And they come to him and say, what do you mean going to war against these people not telling us? What do you think you're doing here? Who do you think you are? And they're just giving him down the road. And his response was, what I've done now can't even compare to what you've done. And it pacified them. That's what this verse is saying. Now later, Jephthah, when they do that to him, he says, you didn't come help me when I had need, so get ready, I'm coming after you now. And they have a great war. Thousands are killed. If you want to save lives, follow the example of Gideon. Great warrior, but he knew how to avoid a fight that was totally unnecessary, where nobody really would win. A foolish pride would storm out. The boss came in, he insulted me, I'm just storming out of here. I want everybody to know how terrible he is. A difficult boss may be hard to work with, but two things we need to remember. Difficult people are everywhere. Wherever you go, you're going to find difficult people. And then number two, they often force us to grow as no one else can. Do you know who has been responsible for me learning a little bit of the very small knowledge I have? It's been difficult people. I don't learn as much from those who come up and say, boy, you did a good job, I appreciate that. Well, I appreciate that. But I don't learn as much from them as I do from someone who says, you need to consider this right here. Aren't you that way? Don't we learn when someone, especially when he's trying to help us, but even if he's not, I can learn from it. And that's what this is saying. Now in verses 5 and 6, there's an evil I've seen under the sun as an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, while the rich sit in a lowly place. Well, we may have to yield to a ruler, though he's not always right. He's above us. We have to yield to him because he's in that position. Haman was supposed to bow down, or rather Mordecai was supposed to bow down to Haman. He chose not to because this is a guy that is cursed of God and I'm not going to do so. A lot of the rulers of this world have not been people with good minds. George III, for example, he was king of England when this country started out of Britain. They say that he used to go around shaking hands with trees. He would actually talk to trees, they say. He had 15 children. I've wondered if that had anything to do with him. I don't think it would take that many. But something wasn't right there. And the latest research I have seen suggests this. It said he was on antimony. And that was mixed with something we call arsenic. As a regular prescription of the doctor. That'll ruin your brain. among other things. And they believe that now that's the reason for his mental illnesses that afflicted him for the rest of his days. But you may have to yield to a man like this. Here's a man who goes around shaking hands with a tree, and then he tells you what to do. You're inclined to say, well, tell it to the tree. No, you better listen to the ruler. He still has power to say, take this man out and hang him on that tree. That's what Ecclesiastes is warning us. And then he talks about servants on horses. We won't get this usually because we have horses for recreation in our day. 100 years or more ago, they were the cars. But he says, I've seen servants on horses while princes walk on the ground like servants. Horses, you think of rule. A person who's a ruler riding a horse. A man who's wealthy. Deuteronomy 17 speaks of kings. Don't you go down to Egypt to get your horses. Don't depend upon them for anything anymore. And isn't it interesting that Mordecai wouldn't bow down to Haman, but by chapter 5, Haman's to bow down to Mordecai. He's to take him by his own description of what he would do for a man he'd want to honor and lead him around on the king's horse with the king's paraphernalia and the king's robe and say, here's the man whom the king wants to honor. And it wasn't himself. It was that man who wouldn't even bow down to him. Fools don't realize how quickly the tide can turn and things can change. James Russell Lowell put it like this, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. I don't know of a time we've needed words like that more than we do today. Unless it's going to be the time that is yet before us. Now, foolishness in verses 8 through 11. Foolishness works. I don't mean that it works the proper thing, but it does stay busy. In verse 8. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. 9, he who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it. 10, if the axe is dull and one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength. But wisdom brings success. This shows us there's danger here. There's some benefits of wisdom that can help us get away from danger. And he starts with a man who is digging a pit. Psalm 7, he made a pit and dug it out. And has fallen to the pit which he made. Who is this? This is an evil man, as you'll see in the context. Look at the next verse. His trouble shall return upon his own head. And his violent dealing, this is the kind of person we have here, an evil man, shall come down on his own crown. Or you see in Proverbs 26:27, whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and he who rolls a stone will have it roll back on him. These are some of the things that he's pointing out here. The expression in Shakespeare in Hamlet was, he will be hoist with his own petard. Hoist means lifted off the ground, and petard is the bomb. Here's a man who goes to set a bomb off. And before you know it, it blows up and it blows him up. The petard blows up and it blows him way into the air and you never see him again. It atomizes him. Haman is like this again in Esther chapter 7 because you have here a man who was wanting to destroy every Jew in the world. And now it's come out that that's what he wanted to do. And that included the king's wife. And they said, here's that gallows Haman made to kill this man who saved your life, king. Oh, that's not good publicity. They take him out and hang him on his own gallows. That's hoist on your own petard. That's digging a pit and falling into it yourself. You have to be careful. You dig a hole in the ground, you're liable to fall into it. And then breaking down a wall. Proverbs 24 uses this of a lazy man. His wall is all broken down, but he won't fix it. But here it's of a man who's breaking down the stones of a wall, one stone at a time, and he's careless, and he's not aware of the fact there's a poisonous snake on the other side. He reaches to get the stone, and it bites him, and there he goes. He wasn't careful. He wasn't wise in how he took care of this. Wisdom would prevent a lot of pain and trouble. It prevents pain and trouble. He would quarry stones, that means tear loose or pull up. We see this was a part of what Solomon did in building the temple. 1 Kings 5:17, the king commanded them to quarry large stones, costly stones, and hewn stones to lay the foundation of the temple. Then you have a man who's splitting logs. Everything is a risk. All that we do is a risk. You walk across the floor to get a drink of water, and you could fall and hit your head and die. The famous dietitian in New York was walking on a sidewalk, Dr. Atkins, and he slipped and fell and hit his head and died. Who would have thought walking on a sidewalk would be that dangerous? He's saying all things carry a risk. Deuteronomy 19, verse 5, splitting logs. When a man goes to the woods with his neighbor to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke with the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes the neighbor so that he dies, he shall flee to one of these cities and live. Last words to his wife were, we're going to go cut some wood. And he never comes home alive again. And this man who did it, though he didn't even mean to, is now in one of the cities of refuge. You go to the restaurant, you eat steak, and a big chunk of it lodges in your throat and you can't breathe and you have to give you the Heimlich maneuver. Now, I prefer not to have the Heimlich maneuver, but if steak's in my throat, I'm all for it. Aren't you? Yeah, that's what we want. We don't know what the next thing is going to be that happens to us. One of the worst things Janet and I have seen was a case where a construction worker had a big stake that went right through his head, right next to his brain, and out the other side. And they got it out, and it was normal. Well, things happen. Accident-prone people had better be very careful, and all of us have to be careful. A dull axe tells us wisdom can help. Sharpen that axe to make sure it cuts well before you get hurt. Use wisdom in a timely manner. Suppose a person is a snake charmer. He's working with snakes. It's too late to call the charmer after the snake bites. Now, in foreign countries such as Egypt, Syria, Persia, and India, snake trainers were well known to have trained snakes so well that they would follow them like a little puppy would follow a master. Now, I never knew why anybody would want a snake to follow them. That's the last thing I prefer. But they'll follow them like a tame dog. They have that power. But that still means you may have a great danger if something goes wrong, because they have the power to bite. So we notice then verses 12 to 15, foolishness talks. I wish this weren't the case, but it doesn't take more than a few minutes on the radio or TV to confirm the truth of this statement. In verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. All the wisdom literature, whether it's Psalms or Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, all of it speaks of the tongue. They speak of the tongue in one way or another and the dangers of not using it properly. A word to the wise is to have a gracious tongue. This was said of Jesus in Nazareth in Luke 4:22. So all bore witness to him and marveled at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. But they were the fools who could not stay quiet. Is this not Jesus? We know his mother, we know his father, we know his brothers and sisters, and here he is speaking these words. Where do you get these kinds of words? Next thing you know, they're trying to throw him off a cliff. They're the very definition of what Ecclesiastes and Proverbs call a fool, in the presence of one whose very speech they had praised. It makes no sense. But it never makes sense when a fool is involved. The fool just cannot stay quiet or still. His words don't defeat the opponents, but they defeat himself when he has to eat his own words, if he's willing even to do that. Proverbs 13:3, he who guards his mouth preserves his life, but he who opens wide his lips shall have destruction. Don't be talking all the time. We're told by Benjamin Franklin, wise men don't need advice. Fools won't take it. I partly agree with that. I believe even wise men need advice, and they will heed it. But the fool won't heed the advice. Now in verse 13, the words of his mouth begin with foolishness, and the end of his talk is raving madness. So he has some silly talk. It ends with evil madness. That shows you the combination here. The silliness along with the sinfulness. So you have foolish words coming from a foolish heart. He has no idea what he's talking about. But does that stop him? No, just like many people we know. Then verse 14. He says, a fool also multiplies words. No man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what will be after him? He doesn't know the present, much less the future. But that doesn't stop him. He doesn't know the present, much less the future. And yet he's going to tell you all of it he can tell you. Chapter 8, verse 7 has pointed this out already. He does not know what will happen, so who can tell him when it will occur? Chapter 3, 22 does the same. In Luke 12, the rich fool did not know that when he laid up all these treasures, he's ready to tear down his barns and build greater. He doesn't know that he's about to leave this world and he's not going to have any of these treasures. He's not going to have any of them. We know in James chapter 4, here's a man who's ready to go to a town and he's going to buy and sell and get gain and make a large profit. He says, you don't even know what the next day is going to bring you. And then we see especially, if you turn to Matthew 12, this one is absolutely incredible. The Lord is speaking. And he's talking in this context of where they have attributed his power to cast out demons to the devil, as though the devil would cast out his own workers. So he's commenting on the use of their tongues here. Matthew 12:34, brood of vipers, that means you children of snakes. How can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. What he's saying is the heart influences the speech that comes out. If the heart is evil, the speech will be evil. Okay, look at this, verse 35. Three times the word good. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things. Good man, good treasure, good things. That fits. Now look at the word evil in the same verse. An evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. There's a perfect match and opposites here. The good and the evil. And then he says in 36, but I say to you that for every, that's an emphatic word, for every idol, and that's an emphatic word because it means even the words that don't even tend to hit a mark, they're a misfire. They may not even go anywhere. Not even important. But every idle word that men speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. If we're going to be accountable for our idle words, what about those words that did hit a target, did tear someone down, did speak foolishly? Then it's even worse, isn't it? The verse 15, the labor of fools wearies them, for they do not even know how to go to the city. He talks till he's blue in the face, and all he gets is a bunch of tired people who are tired of listening to him. Here's the dogmatism of ignorance. He didn't even know how to go to town, yet he's telling people what he knows about God. Isaiah 35:8, a highway will be there, a roadway, and it will be called the highway of holiness. The unclean will not travel on it, but it will be for him who walks that way, and fools will not wander on it. The Lord makes a distinction between the walking and the traveling of the fool as compared to the one who would be righteous in his kingdom. None but a fool, we're told, is lost on a straight road. Have you ever known someone who gets lost so easily that he can get lost on an elevator? Well, I won't tell you my experience, but I'll tell you this. It's pretty easy for people these days to be so mixed up, so confused, they don't know which way is up. They don't know any moral directions at all. And that's what this is talking about. Now, we end up practically where we had in the second point. Foolishness rules. Foolishness also leads. Whether you are ruler or not, the same principle follows. In verse 16, woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. All right. Here's folly in high places. If your child, if you're a child is a king or your king is a child, he's childish. That's Isaiah 3. One of the great threats God gave to his people in Isaiah 3 was, children will rule over them. That means immature people. They're just like children grew up. They never were told no. They don't know how to do anything except get more money, raise taxes, and hurt people. He says, you're going to get what you've asked for when you've rejected God as your king. 1 Kings 3:7, Solomon recognized his immaturity. He said, Lord, I'm a child. I need knowledge. And God supplied it, and he still went astray. Princes feast in the morning, verse 17. That's kind of like the people in Acts 2 accusing Peter and the others of drunkenness. He says, it's the third hour of the day. It's 9 o'clock. We can't be drunk. These are people, what are they supposed to be doing in the morning? Working. What are they doing? Feasting. Fits, doesn't it? Incompetent leaders ruin everything they touch. Rehoboam, 2 Chronicles 13:7. Called a child at the age of 40. He becomes king and he's called a child. So if you're 40, you're still a child. What you've been telling people is true. But he didn't go much further than that. But the point is, he was acting as a child. He was treating people like a child. I don't know if he ever grew up. Rulers live in luxury while the citizens die of a famine. And you see in Zimbabwe a number of years ago, 20 years ago, Robert Mugabe comes in and a once prosperous land now becomes a place to flee. As people don't even have enough money to buy a loaf of bread. $1 million for a loaf of bread. It is absurd in the worst degree. Verse 17. A land is blessed if the king is a son of nobles. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is a son of nobles and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. What does this mean? They feast at a proper time for strength and not to get drunk. An indulgent king is a national hazard. I find it interesting that Aristotle spoke on this. He agreed exactly with what Solomon said. He said, they are truly noble who can point to ancestors distinguished for both excellence and wealth. This is what Solomon just got through saying in verse 17. And then verse 18, because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. Time alters all things for the worse. Lazy leaders bring their consequences. He uses a figure of a decaying building. That's the kingdom of a lazy monarch, a man who won't do the job he was supposed to do. The footnote, the rafters sink and the house of state sinks. Nothing else is necessary to destroy a good country or a good city or a good government than a lazy fellow who doesn't know what he's doing. And then verse 19, bad leaders pursue parties and money and satisfy every wish. A feast is made for laughter and wine makes merry, but money answers everything. He fixes all problems by raising taxes. You need more money? Just raise the taxes. Rehoboam, lower our taxes. My little finger will be thicker than my father's loins. He beat you with whips, I'll whip you with scorpions. I'm going to raise your taxes, thinking that would please the people. That's a child. 1 Kings 12, it takes money to support a lavish lifestyle. And then 20, do not curse the king, even in your thought. Do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air will carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter. Our little things we tell in secret may not say secret. The walls have ears, they say. A little bird told me. The KGB was great at picking out nuances that people whisper to one another. They tell the story about a little child who was helping his mother prepare the table. They're having a gospel meeting. The preacher was coming over, hot summer day. Husband's at work. She's getting all things ready. Preacher comes in, so they sit down to the meal. And she asks the little guy, would you lead us in prayer? And he says, I don't want to, Mom. I don't know what to say. And she made the mistake of saying, well, just tell something, say something you've heard me say. So he bowed his little head and he said, dear Lord, why did I have this preacher over here on a hot day like this? What do you do? Those are words that nobody would have known had she not said them. Sam Rayburn, a Texas politician, said, among my most prized possessions are words that I've never spoken. There's the safe way. We need some prized possessions. Proverbs 1:7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Thank you for your outstanding listening, as is always the case. If anyone needs to turn to the Lord in humble obedience to His will, won't you come all together, we stand and sing.